From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, good grief, it's Charles Schulz. We meet the creator of Charlie Brown, Lucy, Linus, and Snoopy. Schulz has been drawing his popular Peanuts strip for 40 years. Also today, we look at what the SNL crisis will mean to the average citizen with Sherry Edelson of Public Citizens Congress Watch. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles pioneering rhythm and blues brothers Joe and Jimmy Liggins. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg wishes we still used some of the words we used to. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Turkish television is quoting Iraqi President Saddam Hussein as saying that there's no need for Iraq's representatives to go to Washington for peace talks if President Bush is only going to repeat the UN Security Council resolutions. In an interview with a Turkish TV personality, the Iraqi leader appeared to indicate that he'd abandoned the idea of direct talks with the U.S. Efforts to arrange the talks have been deadlocked because the U.S. and Iraq can't agree on dates for visits by Iraqi Foreign Secretary Tariq Aziz and Secretary of State James Baker. European Community foreign ministers have decided not to go ahead with a meeting with Iraq's foreign minister. The decision was made at a meeting of EC foreign ministers in Brussels. Paul de Meissonier reports.
The 12 European Community foreign ministers have decided not to meet with Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz unless he first goes to Washington to see President Bush. Originally, a meeting had been arranged for later this week in Rome upon the return of Mr. Aziz from Washington. However, the Washington visit of Mr. Aziz was cancelled because of the dispute over the timing of the visit to Baghdad by U.S. Secretary of State James Baker. Iraq had said it wanted the talks with the European Community to go ahead in any case, and Mr. Baker had made it clear he had no objection to such a meeting. However, some European NATO members had expressed fear that Mr. Aziz would try to use this meeting to drive a wedge between them and the Americans. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul de Meissonier in Brussels.
According to the latest figures from the Pentagon, both the U.S. and Iraq have added troops to their forces in the Persian Gulf over the past week. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
At today's Pentagon briefing, spokesman Pete Williams reported Iraq now has more than 510,000 troops in the Kuwaiti theater, with more than half in Kuwait itself. That's 10,000 more than the Pentagon reported last week. Williams said the U.S. now has more than 270,000 troops in the Persian Gulf, also an increase of 10,000. He said that figure should reach 430,000 by late January. The Pentagon says troops sent by the U.S. allies against Iraq number 220,000. In Washington, this is Vicki O'Hara.
The Federal Reserve Board announced today that it's taking another step that could bring down interest rates. The Fed said it's lowering its discount lending rate by half a point to 6.5%. The discount rate is what the central bank charges on overnight loans to banks. A decrease in the discount rate often means that interest rates for other short-term loans will also come down. The Fed said that the action was taken in response to requests from many of its Federal Reserve banks around the country. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 33 points today to close at 2,626.75. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 40 years ago, a depressed, insecure kid named Charlie Brown took his place next to Lil Abner, Steve Canyon, and Prince Valiant on the comics pages of the dailies. Peanuts has since become one of the most famous comic strips in the world, but Charlie Brown has always stayed kind of unhappy.
I think there must be something wrong with me, Linus. Christmas is coming, but I'm not happy. I don't feel the way I'm supposed to feel. I just don't understand Christmas, I guess. I like getting presents and sending Christmas cards and decorating trees and all that, but I'm still not happy. I always end up feeling depressed.
Charlie Brown, you're the only person I know who can take a wonderful season like Christmas and turn it into a problem.
Maybe Lucy's right. Of all the Charlie Browns in the world, you're the Charlie Browniest.
That's from A Charlie Brown Christmas, which was first broadcast in 1965 and has since become an annual TV tradition. So we're going to spend some time this Christmas season with Charlie Brown's creator, Charles Schulz. Peanuts celebrated its 40th anniversary this year, and several of the Peanuts books have just been brought out in new editions by Henry Holt. Charles Schulz spoke to us from his studio in Santa Rosa, California. I asked him how often he draws Peanuts now.
Well, I draw as much now as I've ever drawn in my whole life, although I don't work quite as long, but mainly it's a matter of family, I guess. I have always made it a policy to work 5 days a week. I work Monday to Friday, just like real people, and I'm at the studio by 9, and I usually quit about 4 o'clock these days. My schedule used to be dictated by 5 growing children, but now even so, it's just a pattern, and I discover that I work best if I stick to a regular pattern.
Do you put in things into Peanuts that you think and feel now, or do you feel that you rely on memory about how children react to things?
I don't think much about children, actually, and I don't regard this at all as being a strip for children. I think that drawing a comic strip for children would be a wonderful thing, but I think it would be extremely difficult. I don't know of anybody these days who is drawing a really good strip for children. And in the history of comics, which I suppose could be about 80 years, I can think of only 3 or 4 who are ever really drawn for children. So I just draw what I think is funny and what thoughts come to me and what things work out. And I suppose you could say I simply draw for myself.
Now, you get older while the characters you draw stay the same age. Do you think that they've changed as you've grown?
Oh, I think there's no doubt that the characters have changed. I think the entire strip, the whole outlook, is much more mild from what it used to be. I don't think the characters are quite as sarcastic as they used to be, because I probably myself am not quite as sarcastic as I used to be. I think as you grow older, you begin to see both sides of issues more clearly. And my approach is just different, that's all, as I've gotten older.
There's a Peanuts from, I forget the year, it's in the 1950s, where I think it's Linus shows Charlie Brown a scar, and he asks Charlie Brown if he has any scars, and Charlie Brown says, oh, I have lots of them, but they're all mental.
Yeah.
And I think in a way that kind of sums up Charlie Brown's view of life, you know, the mental scars.
Yeah.
Did you find any reluctance in newspapers at the time to take on a subject like depression or mental scars, you know?
No, I don't recall anybody ever complaining about that. What editors were afraid of in those days, much more than now, was the mention of personalities in things. There used to be a very wonderful lady who had a program out of Chicago called Miss Francis, and I used to watch it with my little kids all of the time, and I mentioned her name in a comic strip one day, and some editor complained. He said, we shouldn't be promoting things like that. Well, now people mention almost everything. And of course, comic strip characters are saying things which they never would have said even 10, 12, 15 years ago. They're actually beginning to swear in comic strips now, which I think is a bad policy.
Well, the closest you've come to swearing in a comic is probably Good Grief.
I have discovered in my life that Good Grief and rats will cover almost anything that ever happens to you.
How did you start using Good Grief, which has really become a, you know, popular part of the vocabulary?
It was just a natural thing that I always said. If I was playing golf and I missed a 3-foot putt, I might say, "Oh, Good Grief," you know. But I've never been one who swore. I've never liked ugly words. I have nothing against, you know. I'm not a purist in that way, but I like words to a certain extent. I'm not well educated so that I'm an expert on them, but I've never cared for any type of ugly language, even words that are not considered swearing words.
Do you think of the characters in Peanuts as each representing a different side of your own character?
I think there's no doubt about it. I doubt that it would be possible to do something every day with a group of characters such as I have without each one of those characters being a little bit of myself or being a little bit of the creator. I think this is the only way you can do it. This is why I suppose the characters do change little by little. I try to be consistent in their personalities, but I also think that none of us is ever really consistent in the things that we do and say. We all have our little good points and bad points, and this is what the characters have. I kind of like the theory that my son Monty has. He called me one day and he says, "I've been thinking about your characters, you know, and I've come to the conclusion that Charlie Brown is really the smartest one of the whole group." And I had never even thought much about it, but I have a feeling that he's right.
What part of yourself is Charlie Brown about?
Not as much as people like to think. It just makes a good story, of course. I have not been the loser that Charlie Brown has, although I can remember certainly losses in both baseball and golf and hockey that go back 50 years, and I'm still suffering from them. I think Charlie Brown and I are alike in that we are both fanatics about certain things. I was the same sort of little kid that Charlie Brown was. I looked forward to the baseball games that we were going to have, and if it was raining, I would have been the kind that would have stood out in the rain and saying, "Where's everybody going? You know, let's play the game. Come on, let's go." You know, I was just dedicated to things like that, and I suppose it's the dedication to drawing that has kept me going these 40 years, because I am completely dedicated to what I do.
Do you get depressed like Charlie Brown?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about it. I've been depressed the last few days.
About
I never quite know why.
About what, do you know?
For one thing, we are in the midst of doing a wonderful ice show here at my ice arena, and there's something about seeing all the beautiful, bright young people out there performing, and I listen to the music. The music brings back memories to me, and I suppose I'm just sensitive to that kind of thing. I don't think I'm any more sensitive than anyone else is, but they do affect me. And little things like that do tend to make me feel depressed. Although Rita Grimsley Johnson wrote a book about me a couple of years ago called Good Grief, and she mentions in there my depression. And I think the use of the word depression is almost wrong. I don't know what word would be more suitable, but I don't think that I am what you would call a really depressed person by any means.
Well, you know, when a child is depressed, like or anxious, like Charlie Brown often is, I think that adults sometimes don't understand it and think, you know, that childhood should be a time when kids are more carefree.
Oh yeah.
I was wondering if you were exposed to a lot of that when you were young, of adults maybe not understanding your moods, and your interior self.
I don't know about the moods, but I think the word anxiety is much more appropriate than depression.
Yeah.
I think I am a very anxious person. Now, my childhood was a good childhood, but there were episodes in our neighborhood where there were some cruel children, a couple of boys, and there's one of them. If I ever see him again sometime, I'm going to kill him. they caused me much unhappiness, and I think this is something that adults tend to forget. It's very difficult out there in the playground to survive. It's a struggle out there. And as we grow older, we drift away from that and we learn how to protect ourselves. But children are defenseless. And if they are forced to be out on that playground and they are too small or they're inadequate in some ways and they just can't defend themselves, it can be a very miserable life.
Now let's get to Lucy. Lucy has a Lucy has a psychiatry booth.
Yeah.
Were you ever in therapy, or do you have any faith in therapy?
I don't know enough about it to say I have faith or not. I went through a few sessions over this anxiety business, but the psychiatric booth is really a takeoff, a parody of the old lemonade stands that used to be in comic strips.
Oh, yeah, well, sure.
Yeah. When I was growing up, every comic strip character at some time or another ran a little lemonade stand. And so I was thinking about that one day, and I thought, well, nowadays it'd be much more practical to have a psychiatric booth, and that's how that all started.
How did you come up with Linus's security blanket?
I would say out of the five children that we had, three of them had blankets. And two of them carried the blankets around until they literally crumbled and disappeared. Little by little, chunks would fall off each day until finally there was nothing left. And that was the end of the blanket. And that's what gave me the idea for it. I was always glad that I was the first one who noticed it and used it, because I know if I had not, that Mort Walker, who was very bright, would have latched onto the same idea.
Now, your father and Charlie Brown's father were both barbers. Now, Charlie Brown has no hair. He has that one little lock that comes out.
I don't think of it as not having hair. I think of it as being hair that is so blonde that it just doesn't, it's not seen very clearly, that's all.
Oh, okay. I was wondering if your father always gave you too close of a shave when he cut your hair.
No, but he always gave me haircuts, and when I went to school, I was always looking very nice. My hair was neatly combed, but the embarrassing thing about that was when I used to go into the shop, and he'd be working on me, and maybe he'd be halfway through my haircut, and a real good customer would come in, and he would say, why don't you just sit over there and wait for a little bit, because I have to wait on this man. It was so embarrassing to sit on the bench with just a half a haircut.
Oh, yeah. No, I think when you were 17 years old, you responded to an ad that said, "Do you like to draw?" And you ended up taking a correspondence course through that ad?
Yes, this is the one whose ads appear in magazines and matchbook covers. They used to have a profile of a girl's face.
Yeah.
Anyway, I took the course, and I was too embarrassed to go to a resident art school.
What were you embarrassed about?
Well, I didn't think I was good enough.
Oh.
I didn't want to sit in a class where everybody else was better than I was. I'm like Charlie Brown. I hate being defeated. So anyway, I took the correspondence course, and it was a good course, and I learned a lot from it. And then after World War II, I used to take my drawings over there because they were located in Minneapolis, and I would get personal instruction. And they hired me as a part-time instructor that summer, and I stayed on for 5 years, and it was while I was working there that I developed my own work.
Did your parents know that you were taking this correspondence course, or did you really want to keep it a secret?
Oh, no, they knew it. They were always puzzled by what they could do to help me. I've always been grateful that they never in the slightest way stood in my way for what I wanted to do, even though they couldn't quite understand it. There was no way they could comprehend that somebody wanted to be a cartoonist. I mean, it was just completely foreign to them. So this was just, I think they thought was a good way to help me. The course at that time, I think, cost $160, and I remember my dad even had a hard time keeping up with the $10 a month payments in those days, but he paid for them.
Charles Schultz is my guest, the creator of Peanuts. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Charles Schultz is my guest, creator of the comic book Peanuts. What did you draw before you started doing Peanuts?
I tried several other comic strips. I always wanted to do something about the Foreign Legion for some reason, which is why Snoopy now leads his legionnaires across the desert. And I had another character about a little girl who was kind of a tomboy. I tried to sell her at different times, but it didn't go over. But I discovered little by little by the few cartoons that I sold to the Saturday Evening Post that when I drew little kids, these seemed to be the type of cartoons that editors liked the best.
What was the first strip that you did with a Charlie Brown or Charlie Brown kind of character in it? Did it start off as the strip that we know now, or was there a more, was there an earlier version of it?
No, but the original submission to United Features was a panel rather than a strip, so there were no definite characters. And then when I went to New York to sign the contract, I took along a batch of about a half a dozen strips I had been working on just to show them what else I could do, and they said immediately that they would much rather have a strip than a panel, because a strip just is easier to sell, it's easier to market. So then they said, well, you'll have to create some definite characters. So I said, well, that's no problem, because I already knew I liked to draw a little dog, and I just went home and I asked my friend Charlie Brown if I could use his name, and he said that was fine, and so I created Patty and Shermie, and those were the four lead characters. The first strip that ever appeared, I wish I had never drawn, It shows Shermie and Patty sitting on a curb, and they see Charlie Brown coming from a distance. And Shermie says, "Here comes Charlie Brown." "Yes, sir, good old Charlie Brown." And as he walks by, he says, "How I hate him." See, that shows what I was doing those days, which I would never do now.
Why are you sorry that you drew that, though?
Well, I don't think he should have said something like, "How I hate him." It's a little too strong. Nowadays, I think I would make it more mild.
Now, I know that when you first submitted your comic to the syndicate, that they changed the name. They just came up with the name of Peanuts, and you didn't like the name.
Probably the worst title ever thought of for a comic strip, and I always make sure that when I am interviewed that I say this, because I like to get revenge. But it is totally inappropriate. It has nothing to do with what I am drawing. But I don't think the people at the syndicate, even though they are wonderful gentlemen, and I owe them a good deal because we've become close friends, but I don't think they had any comprehension of what I was going to do. I think the difficulty of being a syndicate editor is that you have to realize the potential of this young person who is sitting across from you when you are looking at his or her work. Is this person a fanatic, or is he or she just somebody who's doing something for a lark? And they should have recognized immediately that here they had somebody who was a fanatic and somebody who was really dedicated. They should have listened to me a little more carefully. Fortunately, titles of comic strips are not that important. Who knows that Popeye is really called Thimble Theater? It's really not important.
What's wrong with Peanuts?
Peanuts, in the first place, is insignificant. It indicates something that is not very important. And also, it is not the name of the lead character, which is what I said would deceive people when the strip first began, and it certainly proved to be true. I just hate it when somebody says, "Oh, I liked what Peanuts and his dog did the other day." That drives me crazy.
No, so what title did you want to give it?
I think I would have liked to have called it Good Old Charlie Brown. But as the years have gone on, I realized that Snoopy would simply have been the best name because he has turned out to be the lead character. But we didn't know that, of course, at the time.
Now, have you ever hired artists to draw for you like most people who do newspaper strips end up doing?
I would quit before I'd do that. The only way I suppose that it could happen would be if I had a temporary illness and I simply couldn't keep up the schedule. But even then, I think we would just drop the strip until I became well again. Before I had heart surgery, I worked very hard, and I got 3 months ahead on the strip because I didn't know how much time I would lose. As it turned out, I only lost a month. But I hope that no one else ever touches the strip, because the strip is me. And this doesn't mean that I'm critical of others who do have assistance. Some of them certainly need them, but I would never want anybody else to do it. And my children feel the same way, and they insisted in putting in our syndicate contract that when I retire or die, the strip goes too, because they said, and I quote, "We don't want anybody else drawing Dad's strip."
Do you have any plans to retire?
All my friends are retiring, and it annoys me to talk to people who are even younger than myself. And I say, "What are you doing these days?" "Oh, I'm retired." "What are you doing?" Well, what really annoys me, Terry, is when they say, "Oh, are you still drawing the strip?" I feel that they should recognize that someone else has not been doing the strip, that it is such a personal strip, such a personal form of creativity, and it really is insulting that they think we could just go out and find somebody else to do it. Now, maybe it could happen, but I like to think, I'm egotistical enough to think that they just can't find somebody else to do it.
Well, I mean, there'd be the very unfortunate option of stopping the strip if you really wanted to retire.
Oh, sure, I can stop at any time.
But obviously you don't want to. I mean, obviously working is an important part of your life.
I don't know how to do anything else, and I don't want to play golf every day. So I suppose what I would like to stop is all of the nuisance things that happen, all of the continual stream of requests that come into the studio for drawings and special appearances and things like that. I've got to try to learn to cut all of that out, and I'm doing the best that I can. In fact, just the other night I said to my wife, "Jeannie, look," I said no 3 times tonight. that was pretty good, I thought.
It's hard for you to say no?
Very hard. And I despise autographing. I hate to say it, but I really despise autographing. But It's bad enough, all the trouble, but then it's the guilt that is laid upon you because you've turned somebody down for autographs. But I just can't stand it anymore.
What's bad about autographing? Is it coming up with something to say or just the whole absurdity of it?
Well, yeah, and my hands shake, and sometimes it's a nuisance. And who wants to autograph a gum wrapper? I had a fella ask me for an autograph over in the parking lot the other day at the mall, and his car was still moving. And he drove by me, and he says, "Hey, aren't you Charles Schultz?" I said, "Yeah." And he says, "Could I have your autograph?" His car was still moving. I says, "This is ridiculous." And I kept right on walking.
You said your handshakes. Is it embarrassing for you to autograph if your handshakes?
Yeah, very embarrassing. Sometimes I'd like to draw them a little Snoopy, but my hand shakes, and that is embarrassing.
Does that get in the way of cartooning at home?
Yeah, I have to. It's not any worse than it used to be, but I kind of prop one hand against the other. And I can't draw as fast as I used to. I used to be quite facile with the pen. I used to be quite proud of the pen line that I had, but I have to be more careful now. But I just draw a little more slowly, that's all. And I letter very slowly, but I still letter very well and very clearly, I think.
Have you ever wanted to do a strip besides Peanuts?
Yes, I never will. I've often thought that I would have liked to have drawn a strip about real children, with the cartooning not being as exaggerated as it is with mine, with the larger heads and the little tiny bodies. I think there is something there. However, we are now caught in this terrible bind where we have such small space in which to work that it would be almost impossible to do something like that.
Is it loyalty to Peanuts also that would hold you back from doing a different strip?
Yeah, because I like what I have, and I think that every thought that comes to me can be used in the Peanut strip in some way or another. I never think of something and say, well, gee, I wish I could use that, but it just won't work in my strip. I have a repertory group here that will accommodate anything that I can think of, whether it's something fairly serious, you know, like certain scriptural references, something from the Old Testament, way on down to something really corny, and then I'll give it to Snoopy, and he'll tell Woodstock something which is just absurd and corny, and they both laugh so hard they fall off the doghouse and land on their heads. those things are really fun, and that's what cartooning is all about. I think that cartoonists have to be very much aware of their medium, because you cannot compete with live actors, television actors, movie actors, radio actors, on their own ground. You have to remember that you can do things that they can't do. Cartoon characters can flip over and do things that live actors can't do, but they can do things that we can't do. So you always must be aware of your own medium.
Charles Schultz, it's been such a great pleasure to talk with you. I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your time with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Terry. I appreciate it.
Charles Schultz is the creator of Peanuts, and this year marked the 40th anniversary of the comic, and Henry Holt has brought out new editions of several of the classic Peanuts books. On the next Fresh Air, a talk with director Tim Burton about his movies Edward Scissorhands, Batman, Beetlejuice, and Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Are you ready to fork over $30 a month for the next 30 years? One estimate says that's what the savings and loan bailout's going to cost every family in America. Coming up, Sherry Edelson of Public Citizens Congress Watch offers a taxpayer's perspective on the SNL crisis. The 1945 recording, The Honey Dripper, was one of the first rhythm and blues hits. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward tells the story of the man who sang it, Joe Liggins. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg pays homage to words from the past that no one uses anymore. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, speaking to Turkish interviewers, declared today that he sees no need for Iraq's foreign secretary to go to Washington. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports from Amman.
In an interview reflective of the stalemate over talks between the United States and Iraq, President Saddam Hussein told Turkish reporters in an interview released today that he saw no need for Foreign Minister Tarık Aziz to go to Washington if President Bush were going to do nothing more than repeat the UN Security Council resolution that Iraq get out of Kuwait. In the interview, Saddam indicated he'd abandoned his idea of direct talks between the two countries and insisted that the only date on which Secretary of State James Baker would be welcome in Baghdad was January the 12th, considered too close to the UN deadline by the U.S. At the same time, the European community declined to accept a visit from Iraq's foreign minister, and NATO member countries meeting in Brussels affirmed the position that Iraq pull out of Kuwait and rejected any partial withdrawal Saddam Hussein might make as rewarding Saddam for his aggression. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman, Jordan.
Both President Bush and Vice President Quayle said today that they believe the American people will support the use of force against Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein if Iraq refuses to pull out of Kuwait by January 15th. However, recent polls indicate that public support is divided. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Bush said today at a news conference he believes the country supports doing its part to implement the United Nations resolutions. And Vice President Dan Quayle, speaking at a conference of the Foreign Policy Research Institute, proclaimed that a majority of Americans believe the U.S. should use its military might against Iraq's Saddam Hussein. Quayle sneered at members of Congress who've been critical of the administration's policy, those who advocate allowing economic sanctions more time to work.
Is it moral to prolong the agony of the Kuwaiti people indefinitely?
But recent polls indicate Americans are almost evenly divided over whether the U.S. should take military action or give sanctions more time if Iraq doesn't withdraw by the deadline. Pollsters say the only case where a clear majority of Americans support military action, as the president and vice president suggest, is when force is offered with no alternative option. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
Consumer prices were up 0.3% last month after gaining 0.6% in October. Some economists had expected lower oil prices to bring overall prices down. Food prices, however, moved up 0.5% in November. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 33 points to close at 2,626.73, volume 184 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, we talk about who should pay for the SNL bailout. You can hear the roots of rock and roll in dozens of rhythm and blues recordings made soon after the Second World War. One of the first companies that sought out the music was the black-owned independent label Exclusive. It lasted for only 5 years, but rock and roll historian Ed Ward says when Exclusive found Jimmy Liggins, they hit pay dirt.
One day at the very start of the Depression, an overloaded two-seater touring car with 9 people in it and no gasoline coasted down a hill into San Diego. It was the Liggins family moving from Guthrie, Oklahoma to a better life in California. 2 of the car's passengers were young boys, Joe, the oldest by 5 years, and Jimmy. Jimmy was very much in his brother's shadow. Joe was a brilliant teenage musician who'd been intrigued by Duke Ellington Records and who was writing arrangements for nationally famous bands within a year of landing in San Diego. By the time he'd graduated from San Diego State University, Joe was playing saxophone and fronting one of the most popular bands in that part of the country. Their regular gig was at the Samba Club at Fifth and Town in Los Angeles, and their specialty was a song Joe had written called The Honey Dripper. It was the number the band would play exactly 15 minutes before the midnight wartime curfew hit, and when Leon René, who said he owned a record label, came to see them, they made him wait till then to hear it. Made history was born that night. The next day, April 20th, 1945, René put Joe Liggins and the Honey Drippers into the studio, and the day after that, he slapped a test recording of the Honey Dripper on the jukebox at Silver's Drugstore at 54th and Central in the center of Los Angeles's musically hip, thriving black community. When he went back that evening, the jukebox showed that the Honey Dripper had been played 135 times in 11 hours. René put the record out and found that he had the first million-selling rhythm and blues record on his hands. Joe was a star. He hired his brother Jimmy to drive the bus and hit the road. He also established Exclusive as the first important post-war independent record label, although he never had a record as big as the Honey Dripper for them again. In 1950, though, Exclusive went under, and Joe, who was still popular, was stuck. But not for long. One day in 1947, his brother had come to him and said, "Joe, I've driven my last mile and toted my last bag." Out of nowhere, at the age of 25, Jimmy Liggins had decided to pick up the guitar and become a musician. Specialty Records, another of the new LA-based labels, signed Jimmy immediately, probably figuring anything named Liggins would sell. They were right.
I had to have a boogie, but the woogie wouldn't wait. Bought me a long black Cadillac 8. It's all reeked, solid streamlined. I'll joy jumping Cadillacs on time. It's the Cadillac boogie, boogie woogie rolling along. Ugh, 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 I. Ugh, 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 I. Look out, gate, don't be late. This roving cat's got a Cadillac 8. Air foam cushions and a modern design. V8 motor body Fleetwood line. He rolled.
Jimmy's records lacked the polish Joe's had, but they were in tune with the times. So when Joe became available, Specialty snapped him up, and predictably, his first record shot straight to the top. Probably the best way to contrast the difference between the two brothers' music is to consider their takes on alcohol. When Joe sang about pink champagne, he did it in a swirl of pseudo-Ellingtonian saxophones. Jimmy had a rather different approach.
Drunk. 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 It's a mean old bottle they call moonshine. Red, red wine, so mellow and fine. Come home at night with a swimming in the head. Reach for the pillow, miss the whole darn bed. Drunk. Drunk.
Record buyers snapped them both up, though. Drunk was a top 10 R&B hit in 1953. Times were changing, though. Neither Joe's jazzy sophistication nor Jimmy's rough-and-ready blues shouting was capturing black record buyers' attention by the mid-50s, and both men dropped from sight, Jimmy permanently. Joe, of course, had his honey dripper royalties and lived well in Compton until a stroke claimed him in 1987, 2 months after he'd played before 200,000 people at the Chicago Blues Festival. The Liggins brothers were true rock and roll pioneers. They opened the gates through which the better-known names passed.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Yes, it's Christmas time. I wonder what Santa Claus gonna bring me this year. Yes, it's Christmas time. I wonder what Santa Claus gonna bring me this year. If he'll just bring my baby home, then that will ease my every care.
This is Fresh Air. While Americans are still coming to grips with the magnitude of the savings and loan crisis, it appears that a crisis in commercial banking is also in the works. The government fund that protects bank deposits is at its lowest level in history. The head of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, William Seidman, predicts that his fund will lose $4 billion this year and $5 billion next. Earlier this week, Seidman proposed that banks carry the cost by contributing more to the fund. But the government is looking to the taxpayer to bail out the savings and loans. The consumer group Public Citizens Congress Watch has come out with a book of suggestions on how this burden on the taxpayer could be reduced. My guest, Sherry Edelson, is a staff attorney at Congress Watch and was one of the principal researchers of Who Robbed America? A Citizen's Guide to the Savings and Loan Scandal. Edelson says the government's current bailout plan could cost every man, woman, and child $2,000.
It would be $30 a month for each family for the next 30 years. It also, not on an individual basis, it affects taxpayers and citizens across the country in that any money from the budget that's taken to pay for the bailout cannot be used for other purposes like health care, education, crime prevention.
I think a lot of Americans feel that it's just not fair that they should have to pay for the SNL bailout. Who do you think should be held accountable?
Well, basically, what we've been saying all along is the people who contributed and benefited from this crisis, the people who have cash and who can invest and gain from high interest rates if they invest in CDs that are offering a high rate of interest. People like you and me and many of your listeners don't have a whole lot of money in the bank and actually have a mortgage, have car loans, have student loans, have charged a lot on our credit cards, and we're paying interest. We don't gain from high interest rates on our savings accounts. So we think it's basically the people who caused and benefited from this crisis should have to pay for it. It shouldn't be on the backs of average taxpayers.
How, though, could you actually single out the people who were benefiting from the SNL policies and charge them?
Well, let me start from the beginning. In 1989, when Congress passed the bailout bill, they authorized $50 billion to be borrowed over three years. But the payments to pay that $50 billion back is spread out over 40 years. So that is $50 billion borrowed in present terms, and then you have all this interest. Basically, as we borrow $50 billion, we're paying almost $900 billion in interest over 30 years. So first thing is to pay as we go. Pay for the bailout now as opposed to spreading it out and borrowing all this money. So that's one way of shrinking the cost of the bailout. But in order to pay for it now, we have to raise that money. So we propose that it be as a, in the form of a surtax on the very rich, on people who make over $100,000, which are basically above the top 5% income brackets in this country, and tax unearned income, people who get income from dividends and stock holdings. So it's not a one-on-one target, to get back to answering your question. It's not a one-on-one targeting of, oh, I see you benefited, now you're surtaxed. It's targeting the wealthy in general, the people who benefited from the crisis. And also the people who had much interest in the financial industry, who probably had a lot to do with lobbying Congress to deregulate and causing the crisis.
But that would be taxing everybody who has a good deal of money, as opposed to taxing the people who have been unscrupulous or taxing the people who really cashed in on the SNLs. Do you think that's fair?
Yes, because the people who have been unscrupulous, if you're saying who have been criminal and who've defrauded the government and the taxpayer, they hopefully are being prosecuted. Hopefully we will be able to recover a lot more than just a surtax from those people. But there's a lot to be spread around. There's a lot of blame and a lot of benefit to be spread around.
The agency that was created to manage the SNL bailout is the Resolution Trust Corporation. How is the bailout proceeding? In the book that you did the research for, Who Robbed America, it's written the first year of the bailout has been an administrative mess and a policy disaster.
Well, it has. Congressman Gonzalez from Texas, who is the chairman of the House Banking Committee, held hearings early in December, and many people came forward and said, I can't even get through to the people there. No one knows what's going on. The right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. We have found incidents where we've asked for certain types of information and we're unable to get it. Information like who is buying the assets that the Resolution Trust Corporation now holds. Information like, is the Resolution Trust Corporation paying the salaries of SNL executives that brought down these SNLs, that made them fail, and they're still on the payroll? We understand that there are a lot of people out there that are still getting paid, even though they contributed to this crisis. The only way citizens can make sure that the costs are kept low and this doesn't become the second SNL scandal in itself, the cleanup doesn't become the next scandal, we have to be kept informed. We have to have access to the information from the agency. And so far, we've just run into a stone wall.
So what exactly is the Resolution Trust Corporation's mission? How are they supposed to be selling off the SNLs and their assets?
Well, first of all, when an SNL fails, the Office of Thrift Supervision, which is the new name of the regulator, goes in and says, boom, you're closed down. We're taking you over. Sometimes what they do is sell off a new institution, a new bank, will come in and say, I want that SNL, I will take the deposits, and then they make a deal as to what kinds of assets they will take. Most of the time, it's a deal where they say that the new buyer can have all the deposits and can, for the time being, will take the assets that it wants. And then it also, in addition, has a year and a half to decide if it wants to give back any more of the bad assets.
Well, what's the purpose of that? Was the government just trying to sweeten the pot for investors who might be willing to buy SNLs or buy their assets?
Yes.
So that they could dump it more easily?
And they're making tremendously sweet deals. In some cases, we've even seen that the RTC is paying these new institutions to take these off their hands, paying anywhere from $700,000 to $9 million to take these institutions off their hands.
So it's been very difficult for the government to unload the SNLs to private investors.
Exactly.
Do you think it would have been better to just shut down the failed SNLs and liquidate?
Well, we haven't seen any figures. No one is showing us any calculations or accounting figures as to whether or not that would be cheaper to do it that way. So we can't make the judgment. We assume that it probably would be a lot cheaper. We also think that right now, as we're going into a recession, or we are in a recession, now is not the best time to be selling. I mean, we bought high and we're selling low. That's the reverse of what you're supposed to be doing. So what we have been at Public Citizen have been saying is, why not hold on to some of these properties? Change the focus of the Resolution Trust Corporation to be a manager. And then when times get a little better, then start selling, making sure that maybe you're renting these places, leasing these places, these properties, in some cases getting them into the hands of low-income people and seeing if they can manage some of the more low-income properties. And then in maybe 2 or 3 years' time, when the economy bounces back, then sell it and make a little more money for taxpayers.
There's a lot of angry people in America right now who don't want to foot the bill for the SNL bailout. There's a lot of frustration in America over this. You belong to Public Citizens Congress Watch, which is, you know, a consumer-oriented group. What are you recommending for people, for angry, frustrated people to do?
Well, that's what we've been running into, a lot of angry, frustrated people. And oftentimes it's, well, first of all, what can I do? Or, needing a solution, or I can't really make a difference. Well, people can make a difference. They need to let their members of Congress know. They need to write letters. They need to organize their friends. I mean, if you belong to any kind of community group, you can organize your friends. You can pass a resolution. You can send it to your city council. You can send it to your state representatives and encourage them to pass something, because this is taking away a whole lot of money that could possibly be going into different programs that are filtered out to the states. So people can do a lot of things, and writing letters to the editor or letters to their members of Congress, whether it be a state assembly or their federal representatives. But you need to they need to hear from you, and not just put the crooks in jail. There needs to be solutions out there, and it needs to be taxing the appropriate people, making the people who caused and benefited from this crisis pay for it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about SNLs.
Terry, thank you.
My guest has been Sherry Edelson. She's a staff attorney for Public Citizens Congress Watch, and the group just came out with a new book called Who Robbed America? A Citizen's Guide to the Savings and Loan Scandal. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. A discussion of Soviet leader Gorbachev's troubles, as evident at the Congress of People's Deputies meeting in Moscow. Moldavian and Uzbekistan delegates have walked out. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from the Republic of Estonia. Estonians going to Finland to earn money, bringing back hard currency, creating problems there. Byron Della Beckwith has been indicted in Mississippi for the murder in 1963 of Medgar Evers, the civil rights leader. He faces a third trial for that killing. Contributor Tom Manoff has a question tonight. Who will replace, in the American mind, the composers Aaron Copland and Leonard Bernstein? And his nominations, Elliot Carter and John Adams.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our language is constantly changing, but linguist Jeff Nunberg says it can sometimes be a poignant experience to watch a particularly colorful word headed for obscurity.
When I was in my teens, I always had this clear picture of how it was going to be. She was going to look like Jean Arthur or Barbara Stanwyck, and at a certain point, she was going to stamp her pretty little foot and look up at me and say, "You big galoot, can't you see I'm crazy about you?" Only I grew up too short and too late. My frame is not what you'd call galootish, and anyway, the word was all but extinct by the time I reached my majority. I'm not one of those people who fear for the state of Western civilization every time the language changes, but I'll miss galoot, and I'm kind of puzzled it's gone. Sometimes a word has to be put out to pasture when it's outlived its usefulness. I have a certain nostalgia for antimacassar, furbelow, and poop deck on purely phonetic grounds, but I can see that it would have been impractical to try to keep them around. and other words are predestined to burn out after brief meteoric careers. It's not surprising you don't hear groovy and far out anymore. Words like those are the Nancy Sinatras and Tommy Sands of the English lexicon. But galoot has been doing quiet, useful work for more than 100 years, and it isn't as if there was suddenly nothing more to apply it to. The woods are still full of galoots, Randy Quaid, Roger Clemens, John Kenneth Galbraith, only now we have to find something else to call them. It isn't just slang words this happens to. Whatever became of dudgeon, meaning indignation, as in the sentence, "The roacher stomps back to the dugout in high dudgeon." This one has been around since the mid-16th century, and then it seems suddenly to have vanished, like someone who stepped out to buy a pack of cigarettes in August of 1952 and was never heard from again. And where did geegaw go after 700 years of honorable service? Or chum, which has been around since Dryden's time? Just think of the publisher that reissues all of the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew books, having to hire legions of editors whose job it is to scratch out every occurrence of chum and replace it with friend or pal. When I checked these words in the dictionary, I found they shared a curious property. Galoot, dudgeon, geegaw, and chum are all marked with the haunting phrase, "of obscure origin." Lexicographers like to speculate about where they came from, of course, and you can always find some word in another language that sounds like the word you're interested in. Eric Partridge thought that galoot might have come from the Dutch word galoot, meaning eunuch, but he had no evidence for the connection and no account of why that word should turn up in English meaning an oafish fellow. Or maybe it's from the French galut, meaning glutton. You can make up your own story about this one. This is what makes etymology such an entertaining pastime, but with some words, there's simply no way to tell where they came from. I think of these as Heathcliff words. They're these dark strangers that show up on the doorstep one day to claim their place in the linguistic household. Some of them are sent to sleep in the barn, like galoot. Others, like dudgeon, plop themselves down brazenly at the dinner table. Yet there's always something a little different about them. And maybe it's foreordained that one day they should slip away just as mysteriously as they arrived. Will they come back as ghosts, then? Words do that sometimes. Take swell. It's been a generation or two since the word was last used in earnest, but people do still say it ironically. That's a swell idea, as if to say, "Where are you coming from, 1940? It would make a nicely romantic ending for the story. Someday I'll look up and glimpse the spirits of galoot and dudgeon gliding over the moor like Heathcliff and Kathy.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy, Roberta Shurrock, and Sue Spolin, and research assistance from Lisa Bocchini and Dan Buskirk. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Tim Burton, the director of Batman, Beetlejuice, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and the new film Edward Scissorhands. Also, humorist Chris Cerf cashes in on sequel mania with a few proposals for his own book and movie sequels. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.